On the Bechdelcast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdelcast.
Hi, welcome to the Bechdelcast. My name is Jamie.
My name is Caitlin.
And this is the Bechdelcast.
This is a movie podcast where we talk about the portrayal of women in movies.
Oh yeah, I forgot.
First, it was announced recently.
Some housekeeping things.
Mm-hmm. Some cool things. It was announced recently. I found an article on Engadget.com.
Cool website for tech heads.
Oh, I am not super familiar with it.
I'm going to pretend to be.
Cool. Mm-hmm. The article is IMDb adds an F rating to help users identify feminist-friendly movies.
Does that seem a little bit condescending?
The F,
it feels,
yeah.
Or just like confusing, like, oh, this movie has an F, but it's
great.
Good. Should be A for ally.
So
that was cool. I like that.
I like it too.
I like that a lot.
So be on the lookout for that. I'm not sure when they're launching that exactly, but.
And then the other thing that we learned about since our last episode is the sexy lamp test, which is sort of a contemporary spin on the Bechdel test that in the sexy lamp, that's a reference to
A Christmas Story,
is it not? Okay, so the sexy lamp test is none of the women can be replaced by a sexy lamp and have the plot remain intact. So it's basically just like a lesson in objectification.
Right.
Which we're down for. We're down. There's so many variations on tests. I mean, on this website alone, the Bechdel test, sexy lamp test, the Mako Mori test.
The Mako Mori test, it says a movie has to have at least one female character with her own narrative arc that is not about supporting a man's story.
Okay.
So it has to be her own. She like has to have her own story that doesn't have anything to do with a man's goal or desires.
And then there's the Furiosa test, which I think is mislabeled here because I'm pretty sure I created that test. And it's more the Furiosa rule, which is that the baldest woman in the movie is in charge.
Yes.
And I think that that rule pretty much holds up. Name me a movie with a bald woman who is not in charge.
I don't know if I can name you a movie with a bald woman apart from Mad Max Fury Road and G.I. Jane.
Oh, damn it. That's what I was going to say. I was like, trump card.
There's another one. The antifreeze test says that no woman assaulted, injured, or killed to further the story of another character.
Hmm.
So that cannot happen, or else it does not pass the antifreeze test. So someone had tweeted at us a while back letting us know about the sexy lamp test. I wish I could remember that person's Twitter handle. I don't. Sorry.
We'll put it in the description.
Yeah. Anyway, a few of these tests were brought to our attention, so now we got some other litmus tests to apply to the movies we talk about.
Excellent.
If we want. Anyway, let's get this moving right along.
All right, let's do it.
And introduce our wonderful guest.
Yeah.
She's a screenwriter, and she has written for Reductress, Natalie Baseman.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, it is a pleasure to be here.
Oh, my God.
Thank you for having me.
Oh.
So one of the things we often mention on the podcast, and I don't like to bring it up, is that I have a screenwriting master's degree.
Guess
who else has a screenwriting master's degree?
What up?
Not me.
Natalie does.
Oh, God damn it.
So,
two
against one.
Are you serious?
It's an MFA.
Guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
I'm triggered.
So,
I'm
Natalie,
triggered. I'm going home.
You know, you understand my struggle.
Oh, it's hard. It's, I went to film school because I love movies, and it made me so I can't watch a movie without destroying it.
I have a much more critical eye when I like can see the screenwriter's hand in like every decision that's made when I'm watching a movie, but I'm still able to enjoy them.
Yeah, well, if the movie's good enough,
sure.
I'll forget about it.
Yeah.
Like the movie we're going to talk about.
I went to radio school to kill my New England accent and develop a very smooth delivery voice.
And it's working.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I used to host a late night R&B show and be like, this is 88.9 at night. If you have any calls, feel free to call in for your loved one. And then it would be like CVS brand Delilah. It was nice. I was like, I hope people are fucking to this. And sometimes it would just be like horny older guys would call in and be like, play a song for my wife. And it'd be like, this next song goes out to Louisa on her 30th anniversary.
I definitely would have listened to your show then.
Thank you so much. I also hosted a show called The Playground where I only talked in a nasal tone. So that's what I did. That's why I'm in debt.
Good job.
Yay. Thank you.
My mom told me today that she has a hard time distinguishing our voices whenever she's listening to the podcast.
I have sometimes too.
Really? Do we sound enough alike?
I think that we have
maybe
a
similar
tone.
Talking in like an Australian accent.
Hey, are we?
Hello, it's me, Caitlin. Is that how it's saying?
That's really good.
It's not bad.
That's really good.
Thanks.
I only have like two voices, which is tricky. I can talk like my former coworker Nick, and then I can just talk.
Let's hear it. Oh. Hey, Nick, what's going on?
Oh, hey, what's going on? My name's Nick Hansen.
I know Nick Hansen.
Yeah, Nick Hansen. He's like, I have a blog about turkey sandwiches. I live in Minnesota. I'm the nicest boy alive.
And I used to like write sketches about Nick. Everyone follow him on Twitter at Nick Hansen MN. I used to write sketches about Nick when we worked together, and I would always make him like a vicious murderer and kept his name. Like, there was one I used to do where I would be like wearing a wig and I'd have a gun under the wig. I would be just Nick going from table to table being, hello, I have a gun under my wig. Do you believe me? And then people would be like, no. And he'd be like, take off my wig. I defy you to take off my wig. It was so much fun. I miss it.
That is a pretty good Nick impression, though. He and I went to grad school together. Again, I don't mention it. I don't like
Oh, my God, Caitlin,
to
I went
Nick.
To grad school.
Oh, my God.
Guys.
Whoa.
In spite of the fact that I've been making cartoons about Nick being a murderer and the cartoons are making fun of his turkey sandwich blog, he sent me and my dad a Christmas card. He's
oh,
a
nice.
Class act.
He's a very nice
Nicholas.
Man.
He sent me a DVD of Ferris Bueller's Day Off on my birthday. I don't even have a DVD player. I love it.
Hey, speaking of DVDs, let's talk about the movie that we're here to talk about.
Oh, okay.
Don't sound so defeated, because it's a movie that we enjoy.
We really liked it.
We're talking about Moana. It came out last year, so it's not as though any of us have a huge history with this movie, but you saw it in theaters, right, Natalie?
I saw it at it was a special preview at my grad school.
Whoa.
Wait, you went to grad school? Tell me more.
Oh, my God.
Sometimes they do special previews. They had a special screening of Moana that was presented by the Pacific Islanders group at the school.
Oh, cool.
Which was really great because there were a lot of students there who are either from the Pacific Islands, Hawaii, or around there, or are descended from there and now live here. And so they were all super pumped for it. So it was just a really great vibe going into it. And then there was an interview with the screenwriter after.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
And was this before like the theatrical release?
Yeah, just a couple weeks.
There. And I didn't know that the screenwriter of this had a hell of a year last year because he also wrote and directed Zootopia.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he was like a woke-ass animator last year.
And he looks
truly.
Like just the whitest dad.
Exactly. Really? Yeah, he for sure golfs, but he also had an amazing 2016.
Yeah.
So you saw it a little bit before, because it came out in 2016, around November, was it?
Yeah, it was right before the holidays, and I just kept thinking about it. I left the theater, and I went in with very low expectations, maybe a little bit higher because I did enjoy Frozen so much. And then I was just so blown away and just listened to the soundtrack forever after, and it's still stuck in my head, and I rewatched it for the third time last night in preparation for this, and it's just a beautiful movie. It's almost everything I ever wanted out of a Disney princess movie, but never knew I wanted.
Yeah, exactly. Every time I've seen it, I've been so emotional because it's like this is what Disney movies should have been like all along.
Yeah.
Caitlin didn't cry, but she did sing.
I did, right. I watched it twice in the past day and a half. So the story is Moana is the daughter of a chief on an island called Motunui. And we learn about this sort of creation legend in the very beginning where this demigod Maui has stolen the heart. I like to call it the heart of the ocean. Titanic reference.
Totally.
But don't they call it the heart of the ocean?
I don't think they ever
movie?
Actually do it. They always call it the heart of Tafiti.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Because, I mean, I feel like that would be I would have loved if there was an overt Titanic reference.
Well, she wears it around her neck. If it was
true,
like a heart,
and
it would
Maui draws her naked. No, that doesn't happen.
That would be Statue gross. Totally
yes,
rape.
It was.
Yeah.
So Maui steals the heart from this mother island, and then it creates this sort of plague that is spreading to the other islands and, like, diseasing the crops and all this stuff. So this starts to happen to the island that Moana lives on with her family, her mom and her dad and her grandma. She also, throughout the course of her childhood, is drawn to the ocean. And her dad's yes. like, you can't go out. It's dangerous. You have to stay on the island. You can't go out sailing. And she's like, but I wanna. So
I think it would be funny if we subbed in cocaine for the ocean for this movie. She's like, I can't stay away. I was born with this desire to snort coke. And then she sings the same song about it.
It would explain how she got to the island so quickly.
Right.
She's just very focused. She's like, I gotta go right now. I'm really fast.
Oh, yeah. No, she's got that coke-addled brain.
Yeah. So she's drawn to the ocean, and the ocean sort of chooses her to, it like delivers her this heart, this little rock that's the heart of the ocean when she's a baby, but she doesn't really know about it. Turns out her grandma found it for her and has like been keeping it for her. And then mm-hmm. when the crops start to get too diseased and there's no fish, she's like, I gotta go and fix this.
Oh, there's a whole global warming climate change narrative. Yes.
Made notes about it. So she decides to, she gets the call to adventure. She goes off. And she takes a boat because she learns that their ancestors were all voyagers. And so she's like, I got to get on these boats. I'm going to go off and I'm going to go to Maui, this demigod who fucked everything up.
I want to back up a little bit to say 10 minutes of topless baby.
Yeah, we do see some baby's nipples.
We see baby nips and progressive in every way. I'm like, you know what? Loving, not aroused by these baby nips, just happy they're here. Happy they're out.
I didn't even think about that, and I'm so happy that's the case.
I think I literally shouted baby nips.
Yeah. Right, we watched it together. This is another movie we watched together.
Oh, we're so in love. LA's hottest couple.
Oh, and when the grandmother, when she's sick and dying, she brings Moana close and says, go, and she says, grab Maui, and you tell him, I am Moana from Montanui, and you will do this. You will sail across the ocean, and you will do this. And just so forceful and beautiful.
Oh, mm-hmm. It was great.
So she does. She goes, and she kind of self-teaches herself.
I do feel like with the death of the grandma, they do shoehorn in a maternal death as a motivation.
But I wasn't bothered by it.
I wasn't either, but it just felt mm-hmm. worth mentioning.
Yeah. Yeah. So she goes, she finds Maui. He is a dick, but we love him. And he agrees.
Good job, Caitlin.
He agrees to reluctantly help her after she convinces him, yeah, you thought you were great, but no one likes you anymore. So mm-hmm. you have to redeem yourself. And they, you know, encounter some coconut pirates along the way. Mm-hmm.
He only agrees so he can go get his magical hook back.
Right.
And then they go do that. And there's a very sexy song.
Shiny,
yeah.
Oh my god, the Jermaine Clement pulling a Bowie. I loved that. That was so good. And You're Welcome, which is the ultimate mansplainy song.
Yes. Uh-huh.
The Rock just really delivers on every level.
So, right, he's a shapeshifter, but he needs a magical hook that was bestowed to him by the gods to be able to shapeshift. So they go and they get his hook, and then he, like, again reluctantly agrees to help her restore the heart. And they go, and there's a lava monster they have to defeat, and she questions who she is the whole time, like, am I the right person for this? Why was I chosen? And he's just, like, egging her on, being like, yeah, why were you chosen? And so she has all this self-doubt, but she's very driven throughout the entire thing. And then finally they get to Te Fiti. She restores the heart. She's the one who does it, even though the whole time it's Maui, you have to be the one to do it. And then she realizes, no, I have to be the one to do it. So she is
she's so special.
Integral in the like actual climax and resolution of the story, mm-hmm. which is great. Last night I was watching it by myself, and I was basically crying the whole time.
So what are your cry moments? Because I cry every time I've seen this movie, and I've cried listening to soundtrack. And it is, last night I tried to write down when I cried mm-hmm. so we could compare it. So what are are the big moments?
The biggest one that makes me the most emotional is toward the end, after Maui has decided to leave, like they attempted defeating I forget what the lava monster's name is.
Taka. The name is Taka.
They attempt defeating her once, and they fail, so Maui's like, I'm going to get out of here. And Moana's like, I've made a mistake. I shouldn't even... You chose the wrong person. Please choose someone else, Ocean. And then her grandma shows up, and they sing a song together, and she's like, I am Moana!
That's such a good... Like, so good.
Waterworks.
The lyrics of that song... Because I was singing along and then realized I actually don't know the lyrics of this. I'm just singing the emotions. But then I looked up the lyrics and was bawling because they are beautiful. It's like there's a line about how the scars make you stronger. And I mean, we might as well jump into it. But I really think this movie is so much about overcoming trauma and overcoming these hard things that can happen to you. And even though Moana doesn't necessarily, she's the savior of the victim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's in that moment, she is so defeated and then overcomes it by just repeating who she is.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
The Disney movie that it most closely reflected for me was Pocahontas, which was my first favorite movie. Mm. I believe that there are hours of home video footage of me just screaming Colors of the Wind at a mountain in New Hampshire at like age 3. But for a couple of reasons, even though like it's, Pocahontas is hinged on, you know, she falls in love with the man. But also she lets him go at the end. But more so like this young woman who goes on an adventure. And then at the end, she learns about herself. She learns about A, B, and C. But then decides that her place is at home with her family. And there's some sort of duty connected to her home and to family. Which I wasn't sure where this movie was going to end. I wasn't sure if Moana was going to leave home or stay. And I think I would have been happy with either. And it didn't bother me one bit that she, like, returned home after this journey all wise and coming of age.
Well, she returns home, but then she's like, guys, let's all be voyagers again.
Right.
And she, like, teaches her dad how to be a wayfinder and stuff.
It is beautiful. Caitlin, what was your Disney princess movie growing up, if you had one?
The ones that I connected with most were Little Mermaid, Aladdin, which... I mean, Jasmine is a princess. It's kind of a Disney princess movie.
She's like, yeah, she's barely in it. I also really loved Beauty and the Beast and the Little Mermaid. But those are both, like, so problematic that I don't even want to admit to anymore.
Yeah, I was a big Cinderella girl. And I would watch both the Disney version and then, like, every other version I could get my
Rodgers
hands
and Hammerstein,
on.
Baby.
The best.
The Brandy
with
version
Brandy and
of
Houston,
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Which, what is so great about Moana is that they really play with the tropes of the fairy tale and of the Disney princess movie and turn it on its head, but in ways that are not jarring, but in ways that make sense. So, like, the fairy godmother in Cinderella saves the day, and also Cinderella would still be there if the fairy godmother never came, and the fairy godmother saves her over and over again, whereas the fairy godmother in this movie, I would say, is the ocean. And yes, she is saved by the ocean over and over again, but the ocean is presented as very dangerous at the start of the movie.
Right.
Almost kills her, and she saves herself.
Right.
She gets her foot caught underneath a rock and then breaks it away and swims away. And she, whenever I was trying to pay attention to it this last time I watched it, that every time the ocean saves her, she has done something to try and save herself before the ocean does.
Right.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I was worried about the ocean kind of becoming a device to get her out of situation, but it never really came to that. It was always, I mean, there were times where it came in as an assistant, but, you know, she was always the one taking action.
Yeah, she does all the heavy lifting.
Yeah, yeah. There is, oh man, it was so good. And I totally agree with you, Natalie, that like all the, you know, displacements of the basic Disney princess tropes were, didn't feel shoehorned or forced or like overdone, which they totally could have been. And the fact that I feel like it's worth mentioning that Moana's body type is like normal.
Actually,
it's like
mildly realistic. Yeah.
As close to proportional as probably a princess style character has ever been.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool. No, like 2-inch waist and all this stuff. She seems like strong, like physically strong and able, which
and
her character would need to be.
Right. And we see her like doing these like pretty amazing feats of strength.
Every time she'd pull a rope, I'd be like, well, that is, I couldn't do that.
Yeah.
She's kind of like Aladdin in that way. She's, ooh, from the beginning of the movie, she is doing these feats of strength and these kind of acrobatics, and she runs up and fixes the palm fronds on the building and stops the leaking, mm-hmm, and then everything with the ship requires so much physical strength.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
On the same topic of like the bodies and stuff, one of cry moment number one, what, the first time I saw it was, so the grandmother was like just a beautiful character and the relationship is wonderful, mm-hmm, but the grandmother's arms like hit something inside of me that I didn't know was there.
Really?
And it was like, you know, even when they show different figures on TV, mm-hmm, it's often larger hips, a larger bust, even a larger waist. But, you know, something like arms are still very skinny and trim and like,
or like sleeved.
Or sleeved. Yeah. Or, and to see this like woman's skin that is alive, that is an old woman's body, mm-hmm, that was, yeah, like, oh my god, those are my grandmother's arms.
Show me that decay, baby.
Yeah.
I was actually going to bring up the grandmother too, because that was the other big thing that reminded me of Pocahontas, except the role of the grandmother
is a tree.
But that tree is dope and very helpful.
Yeah.
Like Moana's grandma. My mom, we had like a tree that, it was not a willow tree. It looked nothing like the tree. But I was so into Pocahontas as a kid that I think she like brought a Sharpie out to our tree, and there was like a little hole in it, like Grandmother Willow's face, and she added a little smiley face with eyelashes. Aww. And then she'd be like, Jamie, look. And I would just go talk to the tree. It was maybe to get rid of me for a while, because I would just go confess to the tree.
That's amazing.
I love that.
Oh, a thing I wanted to mention about her just being physically strong, which that is oftentimes when movies want to like show that a woman character is like not your typical lady,
not like the
they'll
other
make
girls.
Her like stronger than normal, or a trope you see over and over again, which is I don't really understand, is she's good at fixing cars. But for, like
Megan Fox and yeah. Transformers.
And something I forgot to mention in Runaway Bride, Julia Roberts knows how to fix cars, and that makes
She's
her cool and quirky.
Handy.
But anyway, it wasn't like, oh, what a stupid trope to rely on in Moana. Like, she lives on an island, and, you know, they're farming and harvesting crops, and, like, she would have to be
right. It's
strong.
So justified, and we see her getting trained for it, so it like comes from somewhere, and it doesn't feel like one of those lame ass like action movie tropes of like, you know, there's this great, I think it's a McSweeney's piece that I think about at least once a week, about like, I'm the woman and I can kick, and it's like, you know, like the one amazing thing the woman can do, and then the guys turn to her like, what, the woman can do a thing? And she's like, whatever, I guess I can. And that's like the one display of female strength. She like kicks open a door and they're like, wow, we're more horny now, you know, and it's just like so infuriating. And you can feel the screenwriter like grabbing his crotch in a congratulatory fashion.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
There's a moment when Maui abandons her on the island.
We have to talk about Maui.
Yeah.
We have
oh, there's,
so much.
This episode may be 2 hours long.
What a beefcake.
I have
love
so much
him.
To talk about. So she gets trapped on the island because Maui traps her in a cave, and there's like a statue that he clearly made of himself.
Yeah.
And she like crawls up it and then like kicks it over and like uses it to jump into, which is very like Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah.
Moment.
Yes.
And then she like has to climb out of this like hole in the ceiling and stuff, and I'm just like, fuck yeah, dude.
She's just,
yeah, she yeah, defies Maui ahead. So much. I love it.
Yeah.
I love her and Maui's relationship. The whole time I was like, Caitlin, will they kiss and will I feel okay about it? Because there were moments where I was like, is this daddy or boyfriend? You know, like there's moments where their hands would touch and I'd be like, he is 1 million years old. Am I okay with this? And then by the end I was sort of like, you know what? I am okay with it. But then nothing happens.
Nothing happened.
But that's like one of the amazing things about this movie is there is a complete void of romantic interest. Mm-hmm. And that is part of Oh my God, I'm doing a great job. Right now.
There's applause coming from the showroom downstairs.
That's like part of what makes this movie so amazing. And because I think I'm so, first of all, trained to expect, and second of all, genuinely love princess movies, that I was sort of waiting for a love interest to arrive and it never happened. And in retrospect, that's great. Had she kissed Maui, I would be like, okay.
Oh, I would have been furious.
I would have, the first time I saw it, I would have come immediately. The second time I'd be like, hey, maybe that's
this
not
didn't
too
need to be a
hey, he's a million
story.
And no. She's 15.
And yeah. I think that's a real, the only reason why we like Maui is because The Rock is amazing. And because
yeah.
Maui, like when you break down what he does, he steals the heart of this island, which is a god who made him. He essentially rapes her, takes her power, uses it to do all kinds of shit. It becomes his power. And then Moana is tasked to bring that heart back to the island. And all he does is try and kill Moana.
I know.
He is constantly trying to throw her off a boat in
he
the middle
throws her
of
off
the
a boat
ocean.
Multiple yeah. times.
Leave her on this island that he was deserted for years and years. He talks down to her. He is rude. He derogatorily calls her a princess,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting, because I found that to be a little heavy-handed, that, you know, they wanted to get the princess thing in there, but the way they did it, I liked, because she stood up for herself and was just like, I'm not a princess.
Yeah, there's a line where he's like, if you wear a dress and you have an animal sidekick, you're a princess. And she's like, no, I'm the daughter of a chief.
I see his point.
Fuck off.
You know what? I see his point.
And it's both.
Can't it be both? I almost found it to third wave that she's like, I'm not a princess. I was like, you can be a princess. You can just be a better princess.
Mm.
This is the final wave of feminism. And it's invented by me.
Moana is a new wave of
she's
feminism.
She's final wave feminism. It's the last one.
I was going to try to make a pun about ocean waves.
Speaking of bad pun, fuck the Twitter joke in this movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Maui makes a Twitter. Bummer. Every time there's, I was like, why? This movie is dated in no other way except for that horrible joke.
Yeah.
And so that Twitter joke in so many ways encapsulates his character. So he makes a joke that's dumb and bad. He makes a bad joke, which is, you know, when
you're doing a great job, Natalie.
Oh, thank you. When you write with a bird, it's called a tweet, or it's called Twitter, which is a real groaner. And then later on, they get attacked by these coconut things.
Oh my God.
At this point of the month. And we'll get there too, because it's a lot of violence there.
The emoji coconuts.
but she loses the heart. Mm-hmm. Which is the whole reason why she's doing everything, the heart of this ocean, which is this green stone. And he smiles and he's like, but you got one right here. And he holds up the paddle where he etched that stupid Twitter joke where he signed his name in a heart.
Yeah.
And it's like, you piece of shit. You are not taking her seriously at any moment. And I love Maui. I love him. Uh-huh. He's charming and he's got a hot bod. His tattoos are ridiculous.
He's a beefcake.
He's a beefcake beyond. He's a demigod. He's Hercules. And everything he does, when I write it down, is like, I fucking hate you.
Yeah.
You are the villain. You are the villain of this movie.
This is the point where I would usually say in the podcast, I could fix him. I could fix him with my love and my
God,
body,
Jamie.
And I would like
Jamie, no.
To be afforded that opportunity.
Jamie, no.
Okay, The Rock plays a major thing in what makes me horny for Maui, and also probably some internalized misogyny. But The Rock is the most talented man to ever live. If he ever turns out to be a fucking monster, I will throw myself off a building, because he is perfect.
Mm-hmm. I had the same thought today. And, like, what does that say? What does that say about us that we are waiting for the other shoe to drop on these men that we love?
I mean,
because
more often than not, yeah. Like, it, you know, every time, I feel like every time I mention being a fan of a straight man of any distinction, someone goes like, oh no, but didn't you hear? Like,
yeah,
it's so
he
often.
Killed 45 people using a shank he made out of soap, but he's not in jail, you know? And then I'm just like, oh great, now my, you know, I can't love Kelsey Grammer anymore.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Kelsey Grammer, Nicholas Brendon.
Yeah.
We've lost them all.
Fuck, you know? Have we lost Alex Trebek yet? Can I keep him?
I
is he a good boy?
I haven't heard anything about him.
Have you ever seen
him?
Is he a good boy?
By a good boy, I mean not a felon. You know, if you're listening right now and you haven't seen pictures of shirtless young Alex Trebek, treat yourself.
Oh my God.
He has the same mustache.
Your spank bank is so eclectic.
Incredible abs. It's weird.
Amazing.
I have a real thing I would like to say.
Great.
As we tend to find again and again, in spite of the fact that this is so well done in regards to how it treats its female characters, obviously it passes the Bechdel test with flying colors. It is directed by and written by straight white men, which is kind of par for the course when it comes to stuff like this. But I went into watching it with you blind and didn't do my research until after I'd already finished because I didn't want to find out anything that would disappoint me in advance,
yeah.
Such as it was written and directed completely by straight white men. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's not surprising. And in some regards, it's encouraging that straight white men, at least, you know, giving them the least benefit of the doubt, understand that it's now marketable to be reasonable to their female characters and to empower them. But it's still, you know, it's disappointing in its way that it's like, okay, it's great that these guys understand that people are interested in a movie with a female protagonist with a normal body and ambition and, you know, like a really grounded character. But come on, like,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, there are plenty of women screenwriters, directors, and other filmmakers.
Why are they?
There's two of them in the room right now.
Excuse me.
I know. But, so we are hireable.
Triggered. Yeah, it's
I'm here too.
When
you are also you are a very talented animator and editor and filmmaker.
Thank
as well.
You.
When I went and saw this at school, and there was an interview with the screenwriter at the end. It was very disappointing to see him walk on stage and
yeah.
see that it was another white guy who works at Disney, looks like the same. And I do wonder, I think you make an interesting point, Jamie, in that how much of corporate interest kind of goes into those decisions. Because one of the interesting things he said, someone had asked, you made the decision to have Moana's mother be alive because most
right,
Disney
yeah.
princesses have mm-hmm. dead mothers. And he said, oh, yeah, well, she was dead to begin with. Then someone pointed out that it was dead mother and we had to change it.
Mm.
I was like, oh, okay. So how many right. other points did you have to change because someone was like, no, you can't do that.
Maybe this is jaded, but I would say, oh, probably a lot. Like, mm-hmm. if they thought that feminism and positive portrayal of women characters was in no way marketable, there's no chance to me that this would have been, like, a major Disney release. Like, they've received so much criticism over the years. Mm-hmm. And I'm, like, I feel like, you know, with the internet, that's only grown larger and more pervasive, and it's, I don't know, I mean, it really is kind of the best case scenario where it's like, well, at least this movie was made and it's really good, and it's corporate interest aside, it sends the right message to the right people, which is young girls mm-hmm. seeing this movie.
It's a start.
It's a good start.
And yeah. it means that
but
there
like,
are
let a woman get a fucking job for once.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And it's what's upsetting is that so there were women in this process. There were tons of people worked on this film. So there were dozens and dozens, if not more, women who worked on this movie. And they obviously listened to them because
yeah.
if they were giving
yeah, they
that kind
criticism.
Of feedback. And I know their process is very collaborative. But when it comes down to it, when you give the man the writing credit, when you give the man that paycheck, it sucks. That does suck. And I know they are changing a little bit, but the infrastructure of how Disney works is you have to work your way up and you have to be with them for so long and they test you over and over and over again.
Right.
And that's it's then becomes a systemic problem.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in learning more about
that process because that definitely makes a lot of sense that even if women are being mentored and groomed for these kind of jobs now, we won't see it until, 10 years decades. From now when they're given the opportunity to finally do it. But my question is, are women being mentored? I feel like so often, and I don't know how much of this even factors into prejudice, but like people gravitate towards, you remind me of a younger me to mentor. Right. And if everyone working at a high level there is a white guy and custom sort of trains you, and this goes for powerful women training younger powerful women right. as well, but like if you're drawn to someone who reminds you of a younger version of you with potential, then who is supposed to mentor these like younger women animators or like exactly. aspiring directors? I mean, it's something that's brought up again and again, but it's so fucking frustrating. I'm like, does a woman need to just completely self-educate herself and not be guided along in the same way that a guy would be? And it seems like that might be the case of just like, okay, you've got to work twice as hard right. to get the same thing, and you're gonna have to take all the shit along the way. I'm right. just like I'm just ranting.
Yeah, no, you're making all the right points, because then women are put in a position where they like you said, have to work so much harder, it takes them so much longer, they don't have the same connections as someone right. with a powerful mentor does have, so them having those same opportunities is just so much less likely to
right.
happen.
I mean, yeah. And it, it's like sort of that thing where it boils down to like, is your work good? Which I don't think men have to confront that basic truth as much of, not only are you not going to get the mentor opportunities that this person working on an equal level as you who's a man will, but also like, show me what you can do in spite of the fact that you don't have the same amount of access and you have to work twice as hard to get the same thing. Right. And I mean, it is nitpicky to an extent because Moana does so well, but I would hazard to guess that so much of the success of this movie comes from gentle guidance or hinting, heavy or not, from, I would guess, women mm-hmm. that eventually the credit ends up going to these men. And the fact that you were saying that the mother was dead in the original draft is like, of fucking course she was. And it's just another example of like, okay, the woman's going to actually know the right thing to do, but someone else is going to get credit for it. And just, ugh, I'm going to flip a
it's
table.
It's very frustrating. Yeah. Yeah.
I just ranted for maybe 10 consecutive minutes.
Can we talk about the climax a bit?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about the climax.
I always want to talk about the climax.
This is 88.9 at 9. Let's talk about the climax. Yeah.
She realizes, he says, you have to return the heart to the spiral. And so she mm-hmm. goes and she's running from Taka, the fire monster, and she runs up to the top of the island chain, and she looks and sees that it's missing. And then mm-hmm. she looks at Taka and sees that there's a spiral on her chest. And when you're watching this scene, you can kind of see leading up to then that it has a human form, the monster, mm-hmm. but also a very feminine form.
Yeah, totally.
Yes.
And so she realizes that it is...
Taka is Tafiti.
Is Tafiti.
Yeah.
And bawling. Mm-hmm. And she just like, she sings this lullaby, this mournful song saying, I'm sorry, you were hurt, you were victimized, and I'm here to make that good again.
And she, I know who you are.
Right. And she listens. Like, yeah. I was so prepared. Again, I feel like you're conditioned by these types of movies for that villain to be killed.
Right.
And not somehow reformed or revealed to have good qualities, because the lava monster, again, to harken back to another princess movie, vaguely reminded me of the part in The Little Mermaid where Ursula gets huge,
mm-hmm.
Where she steals the crown. She's like, I'm huge now. And she gets harpooned by a man, mm-hmm. by Prince Eric,
yeah,
the hottest prince. and she dies, and then everything is fine. But this seemed like, okay, here's this other monstrous, villainous female character, and not only is it resolved by the female protagonist, but no killing happens.
Right.
I don't think anyone is killed in this movie, except the coconuts.
Just some coconuts.
Yeah.
The coconuts.
It's just a broad representation of male violence.
It's a massacre. The coconuts is a massacre.
But they're adorable.
Another,
so cute.
Another, what I thought was like more Indiana Jones allusions were when they're finally escaping the coconut pirates, two of their ships start to collide and they have to escape through them, which is what happens in Last Crusade. And I was like, fuck yeah.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I'm sorry to keep going back to the mother character, but now that you say that she originally wasn't there, that totally checks out because she barely plays a role in this movie. That was one thing I noticed where all the criticism of like, Moana, don't go, it is from the dad. And so it makes sense that the mother was sort of written out because we have a few moments between her and Moana, but nothing plot changing or significant that I can think of. Most of the oppositional force is her dad. Mm-hmm.
It is her mother who gives her, almost gives her permission to leave.
Yeah.
That
brings her, food for the journey and says,
right.
Maybe even doesn't say anything.
She comes in. Yeah. She comes in and she sees Moana packing for this trip that she has to go on and like realizes what's about to happen. And we as audience might expect, oh, she's about to try to dissuade her from this or tell her she can't go. And instead she like gives her gesture like, yes, here you go. Here's the food you need. Mm-hmm. Off you go.
She understands the drastic nature of what's happening to their island.
Right.
It's dying. Mm-hmm. And the father would have just let it die.
Yeah.
The chief would have just let them all die.
Male pride.
Basically, the metaphor I came up with is that the heart is the EPA, and all the men in the story are like the Republicans who are like, we don't need this.
Whoa.
It doesn't matter that the world is dying. We're fine.
Yeah. And to think a white man wrote it. Wild. At the end, I would like to say that Moana receives a Georgia O'Keeffe seashell that she
the conch shell,
the vagina conch. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I was like, it's perfect that this movie ends on a beautiful vaginal note. I liked it a lot. They did not need to make it pink, however. They were like, you know what this should look like.
I think that's what conch shells look like, though. They're usually pinkish.
Yeah. They're sometimes white on the outside and pink on the inside, but this was like deep.
Just
pink.
Like
this
me.
This was like...
You could also see the
this
clay.
Is a puss. Yeah. And the shell did come. It just squirted salt water. And was like, all right, we get it.
It's all over
this
that
This is a hot movie. Yeah. Moana fucking rules. She's the best. I like that she's such an empowered character that they didn't need to give her the standard best friend character, which I feel like a lot of Disney princesses have, is like a female friend to be like, hey, you're great. And, you know, Moana is great. And that just comes across. We don't need this ancillary person to be like, you're hot.
Yeah.
We like you. It's like, of course we like you. You're Moana.
Right.
And she knows it too. She's so confident. She screams, I am Moana. I was like, oh, God, I want that for 1 second. I want to feel that way.
She's confident, but it's also balanced by, like I said, the self-doubt that she has about, like, is this mission the thing that I'm supposed to be doing? Am I capable of this? Which is just very realistic. It just shows that she's a dynamic, well-written, interesting character and not just, like, what a lot of Disney princesses have been, which is pretty just one-dimensional and flat and boring.
Right.
One of my favorite moments of the film And it's a film.
It is a film.
Is right after she sings I Am Moana. And she dives down to get the heart back because she's thrown it into the ocean like Rose at the end of Titanic.
Right.
Giving it back. She goes and she gets it and she... And it's the music swells and she bursts back up and the music cuts out and she's... The ghost of her grandmother is gone. Her boat is broken and she is alone in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And it is just this beautiful moment of, oh my God, this is still so dangerous for her. And this is the moment where she has the most confidence and where she is about to kick ass.
Yes.
Yet it is stark and quiet and she is alone. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it's just like a punch in the gut, but then a good punch in the gut.
And we have Stupid Chicken to provide.
Oh, Stupid Chicken.
Love
Stupid Chicken. Was clearly for, like, the younger kids who went to see the movie who, like, aren't smart
enough.
It's
the Ice Age squirrel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They're like, this is a goofy physical.
Speaking of Ice Age, that's the voice I can do.
Yeah, stick with that one.
Yeah. Hey, guys.
I don't know what to do with myself right now.
So I did some research on the directors, and I know we touched on the fact that they're straight white men, but I think their history with Disney is also super interesting because they also directed, I guess, what is considered the second most groundbreaking Disney princess movie, which is Princess and the Frog, first African-American Disney princess. So I guess it sort of makes sense that they were selected to do this other female progressive movie. I would also argue Brave did a lot of great things. So I thought that was interesting. And then years and years back, they directed both The Little Mermaid and Aladdin, which I think we've referenced in different ways in both of these. So
one of the interesting things that the screenwriter talked about, is it John Wells? Is that his name?
John, let me look it up.
There's a few different writers.
Yeah, the one who's kind of credited.
John Musker. Oh,
wait, no, that's one of the directors. Jared Bush. Yes, that is
Jared
right.
Jared Bush.
Jared Bush, yeah.
Okay, I said John Wells, so it was not right. I don't know who John Wells is. But one of the things he was saying was Disney overall, because they had these basically patriarchs of Disney animation who were working on this project, that they wanted to have some of that kind of old school Disney animation in the film. And so specifically, it was their idea that during You're Welcome, the song, when it switches to both 2D animation and 3D animation, that was their ode to kind of harkening back to that time because they were so good with it.
That's so funny because I remember thinking when we were watching that number vaguely reminded me of Friend Like Me when they kept switching to different backgrounds, and that sort of carried through as, and they were the directors of Aladdin. There you go. Also, we've got to talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda. Love Hamilton. As a person, think Lin-Manuel Miranda is so obnoxious. Hate watching him talk. Respect the fuck out of his work.
Yeah.
And that is my stance on Lin-Manuel Miranda. But
I would like to take a moment to brag and say I once went to a college party with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Wait, where?
Thank you. It was at UMass. And his improv team, Freestyle of Supreme.
Of course.
His beatboxer went to UMass, and so they came back.
Of course he is a beatboxer.
I don't remember anything about him from the party, but I remember he was there.
That's pretty cool. That's really cool. And I loved In the Heights. His first musical is so good, and he's so good in it. But he's just, as with any major figure, it reaches a point where it's like, okay, you're too present. Like, take a step back, pull an Adele, have a baby, you know, get your life together. Yeah, take a step back and then come back and we'll be like, oh, we missed this guy. Right now it's like, get out of my targeted ads. I'm sick of this. But he didn't write all the songs. He wrote some of the songs in this movie. And I feel like you can sort of tell exactly what they are once you know that he wrote on this movie. Like, You're Welcome, like, stinks of Lin-Manuel Miranda and his style. Stanks of him.
Can we talk about top knots in this movie?
Yes! Loved the role of top knots in this movie.
What is that?
The hairstyle of, like, when it made sense for Moana's hair to be out of her face, it was fucking out of her face.
Yeah.
It was great.
Same with Maui, though.
Same with Maui!
Yeah, he's
a little man bun
top knot.
I had no idea that's what the hairstyle
is. Beefcake top knot. That's the name of my new really bad improv team.
Yeah.
Beefcake top knot.
One of the things, this is a little off topic, but going back to the beginning of the story where she's poised as she's going to be the next chief, even though she's a woman, she's a girl.
Right. Never questions.
Usually, yeah, never questioned. She's just like, you're our daughter. You're going to be the chief because you're the daughter of the existing chief.
Out loud. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's never like, oh, but you're a woman, so you need to marry a boy so that he can be the chief.
No curriculum introduced.
Right, exactly. So I love that's just never a thing that's brought up. It's just like, yeah, you're the chief because you're the descendant of the current chief. Doesn't have anything to do with your gender.
Right.
Love that. And you see her she's like kind of in training before she leaves the island to go off on the journey. And she's like making important decisions about the crop. Oh, these trees are diseased, so we have to plant a new grove over there. And here's all my suggestions about how we can fish differently and all this stuff. And she's like giving sound advice and really like making important decisions. Mm-hmm. And it was just like so refreshing to see.
She was never really questioning herself. Yeah. Then.
No.
She only really started to question herself when she got into the ocean, when she explicitly had her father's permission.
And that made sense in context because she genuinely did not know what she was doing first time, where it's not like she's not doubting herself because she's a woman. She's doubting herself because she doesn't know what she's doing.
She's never done this before.
And then when she figures it out, that doubt more or less goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was dope. Loved it.
Another thing I wanted to point out is that it's so seldom that when there's sort of like a chosen one in a story, it's almost always a man.
Mm-hmm.
You got your Harry
Potter.
The
Matrix.
You got your, Neo from The Matrix. You got your Frodo Bagginses and your Luke Skywalker.
A lot of diminutive men are chosen as the one.
Yeah, the second time I watched this, I watched it with my boyfriend, and halfway through, he was like, "Oh, so this is Star Wars?" Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Star Wars,
sort of. Yeah, I mean like in the hero's journey, power of myth kind of sense,
a classical call to adventure. But so often, it's a man who's doing that. Mm-hmm. It's just again so refreshing to see it as a woman, because we so rarely see that.
Although I do, when someone says chosen one, I do automatically think of Buffy, but that's because Buffy hit me real hard at a very specific age. And so that's just stuck with me.
I think it is cool that, because this, when you map it out, it really is a very, very, very standard hero's journey, but a hero's journey that is usually for a male character. Like it's not a princess's journey, it's a hero's journey. Which I mean, I don't know, if this were a story about a man, it would be boring. It would not be super interesting to see a man be like, I can do things, but sometimes I'm sad, you know. But when we see Moana do it, it's so crazy and like reflective of our own culture that we're like, what? This is the coolest thing ever. Because if we made her a man, I don't know how much I would have liked this movie. Yeah. Probably not that much.
It would have just been like, okay, cool. Like,
okay, cool. Great. Yeah, another one.
Good for you.
She really didn't have any major flaws that were, you know, kind of preyed upon for story or as faults of her own.
Do you think that's a bad thing or an okay thing?
I don't have any problem with it in this movie.
I mean, I think the only person who really goes after her is Maui, and she's gone after mostly for youth and inexperience.
Right.
Like, I feel like that's the most commonly cited thing of, he doesn't toss her out of the boat to certain death because she's a woman per se,
but rather because
he doesn't see value in her skills.
And because he keeps saying, because you're mortal, you're a human.
Right. Regardless, she is tossed out of a boat multiple times.
Left to die, constantly left
die. Yeah. The ocean saves her.
He gets a tat of her at the end.
I know, it's really
heartwarming. Oh my God. Aspirations.
There's a couple. So when the coconut pirates attack them,
the coconuts.
There's a couple different times where she either saves Maui or saves herself, toward the end of that scene or that sequence, she's like, all right, you're not going to help me, I'm going to go do it. And she has to be the one to retrieve.
She knows coconuts.
She knows coconuts.
They're just sentient.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's when they were far away and when they were lots of them and when they were approaching and they were menacing, she was scared.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she found out that they were coconuts, she lost her fear and she was like, oh,
I can handle that.
I can handle this. Yeah. Even though they still were dangerous, they still were shooting.
Those coconuts had darts and knives. They're also, talk about like, and not to take away from the value of the coconuts as characters, not that scene could have easily been taken out, but that for me, that was like, what an excellent marketing move. Let's introduce these adorable emoji like characters that are slightly violent but ultimately very cute that we can put on a backpack. It was I think when we were watching it, I equate them completely to the aliens in the alien toys in Toy Story, of just like, here are cute things that people will be like, oh, the I little coconut
guys. I want to buy this little toy for my little boy.
I want this pencil so this movie, case of the coconut boys.
This movie can make more money in merchandising.
Give me a backpack of the coconut boys. Give me a little alien backpack. That said, I would get a backpack of the coconut boys.
Oh, for sure. They're I already have a whole collection of the figurines. No, that's not true.
There was the one part of the movie that felt like, oh, this feels like for kids.
That could have
like,
been,
this is
yeah.
for kids.
See, I thought that's
but also it's a kids movie, so that's okay.
Right. True. That was the one scene that I was like, how different would the movie be if that were, you know, there's so many scenes where Moana takes action and agency that I feel like, that's the emoji coconut scene. Mm-hmm. That was for the backpacks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh, can we talk about her going to the monster realm?
Yes.
Because again, she is told to stay put, that she's not going into the monster realm, and she immediately follows him up this giant mountain mm-hmm. made of these pillars like the giant's causeway and goes there, and then he's like, all right, are you gonna jump in with me? Doesn't think she's going to, and then does. Mm-hmm. Which is awesome, and it was very scary, and all these cute scary crazy monsters. And then we meet this like amazing crab who is another version of greed and masculinity in this pompous way, but also in a very lovable way.
Mm. Yeah, oh, yeah, what a lovable villain song.
Mm-hmm. So sexy. Yeah.
Disney villain songs are always the best Disney songs.
Always. I was worried. I mean, I was telling you, I was like, is there not a villain song? It's because if there's not a villain song, where's the best song? This is a great song.
Yeah. I really enjoy it.
Jermaine crushes it.
He's so sexy. How many times am I going to say this?
He's the horniest person alive. Every time he speaks, or especially when he sings, I'm just like, you're for sure rock hard. Like, how he's singing this song as a crab, but he's like for sure erect.
Are you sure that's not just how he makes you feel?
No, I don't get erect.
It makes me feel that way too.
I'm a sexless being.
Oh, I see.
I don't see sex. But
I'm a person of sex,
but like I don't see sex. Mm-hmm. But he's deeply horny.
And in that scene, it's Moana who saves the day.
Yes.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
She does not get horny.
She does not get distracted by
the
horniness.
Sexual glam rock
right.
at play.
Yeah.
She saves Maui and she allows them to escape. Mm-hmm. This is another example of one of the very few movies with a woman lead that the stakes are life and death. Because so mm-hmm. often, if there's a female lead in a movie, it's a rom-com where like the stakes are very low.
Am I gonna get a date?
Right. Is this guy gonna fall in love with me?
And the stakes are related mostly to men, and the stakes were not related to men.
Right.
They were related
right. I
to
mean,
all people.
I feel like a lot of times with like the princess movies too, it's like the biggest risk for the female character is just going back to where she started, where like, had Aladdin not swept Jasmine off her feet, she would just still be a princess.
She'd be married to that Prince Ahmed.
Right.
Who was a jerk.
He was such a punk. And then Ariel, if she couldn't get Eric to kiss her in 3 days, I guess she would have turned into a weird Ursula shrub. I guess that was a little bit higher stakes. Belle.
But she risks her whole life for him. She's
right.
The whole thing starts
it's
because she
her.
Has a bone for Eric, which get it, but
grow up.
Grow up.
But it's I think that
I'm 16
shows,
years old. I'm not a child.
Yeah, they're both 16. Because Moana
true.
Is 16, so it's nice to show I wasn't sexual at 16. I was thinking about things, but I didn't know what I had no tangible idea of what sex actually was.
Right. Yeah.
So Moana is a much more relatable character to me because at 16.
I didn't get my first kiss until I was 16. It was scary. I didn't know what an erection felt like. I was like, oh no.
Wait, why was there an erection in your first kiss?
That's on him. I don't know.
It was on him.
It was on him.
I think
physically.
You told this story. You guys were standing on a rock or something?
Yeah, Boner Rock. We're standing on Boner Rock, it was henceforth known as. And the first saxophone player of the band was like, I think you're great. I was like, thank you. And then he kissed me. And then I was like, what's going on? Because we stood up and we should not have stood up. But also, there, I was so undereducated about sex that the first time someone went down on me, I was horrified and thought it was his idea. Like, he had made it up.
Oh, he invented oral sex.
He invented oral sex on a woman because I was, you know, he was, we were what, like 17, 18? He wasn't good at it. And it was happening. I was just remember thinking, like, this is deviant behavior. Like, why would someone do this? I feel far away from the action.
Did you not learn about, I feel like,
I did not get sex education.
Oh, I see. At all. I got like abstinence plus education, but I think they mentioned oral sex.
Yeah. Well, the first time someone went down on me, I consulted someone younger than me. I consulted a sophomore in high school. I was like, have you ever heard of this? Like, what? Or do I need to call the police? And she's like, no, that's extremely common and actually is considered like maybe a good thing. And I was like, oh, okay, well, I don't want it again, but glad that I don't need to call an ambulance for myself. I wish I'd called the cops.
Hello, and been
like, someone's face is on my vagina and I don't like it.
Should we send a
patrol car? Like, what?
How old is he?
Sorry, gang.
There's a moment where Moana has to stroke Maui's fragile male ego.
Yes.
Because he's like, I'm not Maui without my hook. Blah, blah, blah. And she's like, just grow up.
Yeah.
And he just.
Well, I mean, I would argue he sort of does the same thing for her when she's feeling insecure. Not to say he is like this terrific character, but I think that is almost a mutual thing where there are times in the movie where Moana needs to be pumped up a little bit and made to feel confident. And the grandmother character serves as that boost a lot. But there is at least one instance where Maui is like, no, you know what? You're doing a good job and you're ready and you're capable. It doesn't come till later in the movie.
Right. It takes him a long time.
That didn't bother me too much that she encouraged him once. That almost felt like
It didn't bother me. I'm merely just pointing it out that it's a thing that needed to happen because
he needed to be able to return.
Yeah, just and, very fragile egos that need
right. And boost. he owed her more of like a boost than she ever owed him because was not great to her. Right.
Oh, he again. I love Maui. I'm so glad everything works out at the end. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't the Rock, he that gets forgiven. True. He gets elated into being this demigod again and forgiven because he helps Moana restore the heart to Tafiti, which is great. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that Tafiti forgives him and gives him his hook back.
Yeah.
And gives him a new hook. And I think that is incredibly female. Not just forgiveness, but forgiveness on such an incredible scale.
Right.
Because he doesn't really deserve it. And even at the end, Moana has to like hit him to like bow to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like show some goddamn respect.
And we're supposed to have empathy for him because his parents tried to kill him or threw him into the ocean when he was a baby. And then he was saved by gods. And it's like, if that isn't such a male narrative, I don't know what is.
Right. The same thing happened to Shrek.
It's like because of this horrible thing that happened to you, very early on, you immediately got incredible power and then you abused it and abused it and abused it and were punished for it and are now punishing the world trying to get it back.
That's a Shrek narrative if ever I heard it. Shrek is isolated by his parents at a very young age, as is the ogre tradition. Mm-hmm. Shrek strikes out on his own, establishes his own swamp to his credit. Mm-hmm. You know, he comes from nothing. He's got his own swamp now.
He's a small business owner.
He's got his own swamp. He built a life for himself, but he's kind of mean. He's kind of resentful towards the world, and he's a bully to all the other fairy tale creatures. Yeah. And then the rest of the movie takes place.
Yeah.
Kind of a Shrek narrative. I'm just playing that.
Yeah.
Shrek, another beefcake.
But it's a relatable narrative, both for men and women.
And ogres.
And ogres. Ogre people. Ogre Americans.
Sorry, ogre Americans, we call them.
Right. Bottom line is that all of her actions and her choices drive the narrative throughout the entire movie.
Absolutely.
Like, everything she's doing, it has a consequence, it has a bearing on the story. She is the driver of the vehicle that is the plot. And like I mentioned before, she's the one who determines the outcome of the story. Like, she's the one who restores the heart.
And, like, more often than not, it's, like, a man who's throwing a wrench into things rather than swooping in as a savior. Right. Like, Maui, for the most part, he does play a role and he does help and there's teamwork. But more often than not, I feel like he just presents a problem.
Yeah, he's there often to create obstacles for her.
One of the reasons why I cried so hard when I saw Frozen for the first time and then again when I saw this was just thinking about a generation of children, of young women who get to see this movie.
Yes, I had the same thought.
And it's beautiful, and it's beautiful for them to see Moana as a hero, but also to see Maui, how to interact with Mauis, because you are going to come up against Mauis for your entire life. Mm-hmm. And if the lesson of this movie is that you have to grab them by the ear and tell them what you want and make them do it. Mm-hmm. It's in this world that has to be done.
Yeah.
Right.
It's absolutely great how defiant she is toward him and toward her father. Her father kept being like, don't go off beyond the reef. It's too dangerous. And time and time again, it got to the point where it became the inciting incident where she then ventures off into the great unknown. But
again, sub out the ocean with heroin, and it's so funny.
Oh, I thought it was cocaine. Yeah.
It was cocaine, but now let's raise the stakes.
Black,
now
it's heroin.
He's like, no, and she's like, I am naturally inclined to enjoy this beautiful natural element that is black tar heroin.
Anyway,
why haven't any princesses been addicted to drugs? Where's that movie? I'll direct it. My goal in my life is to make a movie about conjoined twin royalty. And then they try to get separated and like one dies. And then the inciting incident is that she's got to go, and there's a whole, I have an outline, I'll send it to you.
Okay. Hey, I'll give you notes.
Thank you so much.
This is a callback to an earlier episode.
Yeah.
Hey, here's something I thought, this is just a dumb fun thought I had, is on the coconut ships, there's this big drum and they're all attached to ropes and they like come down on the drum and beat the drum. And it reminded me of Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, the drum vehicle guy! The steampunk drum guy! Mm-hmm. Another fun thing in the outline of this conjoined twin princess movie that I've outlined, the surviving conjoined twin is a woman in STEM.
Oh, good.
Oh, my gosh.
So it really is the most empowering movie of all time. And she's also a lesbian.
Well, because she has to dedicate her life to science.
She also can fly a plane. And she's pretty amazing.
That's great. I will definitely
It might be extremely bad.
Cool. Does anyone have any like final thoughts about the movie?
I just love it.
It's amazing. It's an amazing movie.
It's beautiful.
I was worried you might not like it, Jamie.
Really?
Because you just saw it earlier today.
Yes, I did.
And so, yeah, I don't know. Well, I had hyped it so much that I was afraid that it wouldn't live up to the hype that I had created.
Yeah, I mean, I knew you loved it since you saw it in theaters. But, no, I mean, it's like, it's so good on every level. Like, we don't even need to talk about whether it passes the Bechdel test. It absolutely does in the first, like, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I was talking to a comic who had seen it and taken his son to see it, and it had been too worked up, and they did not like it. And the thing is, I didn't care.
No.
I was like, it's not for
it's
you.
It's not for them. Exactly.
It's not for you, and I don't care.
I want little boys to love this movie, but it's not made for them.
Yeah. See, I think it is important for them to at least see it and understand the and like at least take away something from it, because it might put a damper on toxic masculinity that is part of why the patriarchy is still a thing. So I think the more, you know, little boys can become enlightened to
for sure.
I think so too. I mean, I got something from Toy Story, but that movie wasn't made for me.
Right. I mean, and we as little kids were forced to see all fucking manner of male heroes' journeys or like this beautiful French woman's fucking a dog in a suit. Like, we were presented with very few options.
I'm sorry, which one was that?
That's Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, yeah.
There's like, but there, you know, it's, I would love for little boys to be forced to watch Moana, but there's so many other options for them where they can be like, oh, I'm great. And I hope that that goes away. It's hard. I mean, it's hard because I don't know how Moana was marketed, but so often, like, these really good, empowering, female-driven movies are sort of Barbie marketed to the point where it's like, oh, if you were, you know, the everyday parent, you wouldn't think, oh, I should bring my little boy to this movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what the solution to that is. I mean, you can un-Barbie-fy it, but I don't know how much inherent prejudice goes into
that. Well, I think Maui's character was kind of big in every marketing piece.
I remember that.
They were selling The Rock pretty hard on it.
I mean, when you've got The Rock,
you got to sell advantage The Rock. Of it. I do kind of want to talk about the scenes that passed the Bechdel test, though, just for one, consistency with our podcast, and two, because they're great. First one comes when Moana and her mom are talking about Moana's desire to just be out on the ocean and to venture off. And her dad is mentioned, so, but it's not, the context of the conversation is not really about him. It's more about just her desire and her longing to be on the ocean and in the ocean. A similar conversation happens a little later on between Moana and her grandmother, where Moana's talking about putting the stone on the top of the mountain, which is like symbolic of her accepting her role as the leader and the chief mm-hmm. of the community. And she's questioning like who she's meant to be. And again, her dad is mentioned, but again, that's not really what the conversation is about. It's more about like her destiny and her desires. And then another conversation between her and her grandma happens. Oh, I think it's just after she discovers that her ancestors are voyagers.
Mm-hmm.
And her grandmother shows her that.
Right, yeah. Her grandmother's like, bang on the drum and your questions will be answered. And then after that, her grandma's like on her deathbed. And that's when she's like, you have to go find Maui and tell him to restore the heart.
Also, they do a rare displacement of the horny grandma trope. This grandma doesn't get horny, does she?
Mm-mm. Just horny for sea creatures.
This horny.
Yeah.
Well, that's
for
true.
Stingrays.
Oh, God damn it. Because the other grandma character that I can think of besides Grandmother Willow, who can't get horny, she's a tree, is the grandmother in Mulan, who is very horny. Mm-hmm. Also very helpful.
Mm.
Helpful and horny.
Well, I don't think it's actually fair to say that she's horny for these stingrays. She wants to be one, and she admires them, and it doesn't mean she wants to fuck them.
She's empowered by the stingray. So, okay, yeah. I really want to give this grandma every benefit of the doubt, because I really love her. And all the other grandmas besides the tree are horny.
Hey, should we rate the movie?
Let's do it.
So we rate each movie on a scale of 0 to 5 nipples, and then we describe the nipples if we so choose.
Okay.
I'll go first.
Is five
is the highest.
Five is the
rating.
Most nipples.
Like, great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I think might be what I give this movie.
This might be the first five
this
nipple movie.
Might
yeah,
be the first five nipple movie. The only thing that would make me hesitate about it is the fact that the filmmakers, the directors and writers were white dudes, but that doesn't really seem to have a bearing on the story the way we might think. So if you're just isolating the narrative itself and not thinking about the filmmaking aspect of it, it does such a terrific job representing women in a way that Disney movies and movies that young girls are seeing haven't really done before.
Mm-hmm.
The relationships between the women characters are so wonderful and strong and refreshing to see. Moana just has so much agency and she's so active in all of her decisions. And she's just a great, dynamic, multi-dimensional, very lovable character. And I love her so much. Yep. Five nipples.
Yay. Five nipples. Describe them.
Well, I'm not... Okay.
Describe them.
Five
this
of them.
Eight, 9 at night.
So I know that crabs don't have nipples, but five nipples belong to...
Little pinky nips.
Aww.
Tammy Tua.
Jermaine the Crab.
Oh, maybe I wrote it.
Jermaine
down.
The Crab. Hello.
Jermaine the Crab.
It's me, Austin.
Britt
and Caitlin.
Where's Britt?
Britt and Jermaine.
Britt. I give this movie 5 nipples as well.
Great.
I would be interested if anyone's listening in how, if anyone is familiar or integrated into Pacific Islander culture, how you felt the movie represented that, because I really don't have a context for that. In a layman's sense, it seemed like it was pretty respectful of the culture, but again, if you have more knowledge or insight,
outsiders.
Yeah, we would love to hear it.
I was trying to read about, like, whether or not Moana was based on any folklore or mythology or anything like that, and Maui and the different creation stories and stuff like that. It seems that they took like a combination of different like Polynesian and Pacific Islander things and sort of like molded it into one thing. And I think there was some criticism about that from those communities that like, oh, like, why did you mesh them all together? This kind of thing.
There was also
Disney has a resort in Hawaii.
There was also a Maui costume that was released that was considered disrespectful and was pulled from the shelves. A real merch mix-up. Regardless, I give it 5 Moana baby nipples.
Mm-hmm.
I would also give it 5 nipples.
I love it.
Well, Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I feel like this might also be one of the first times that all 3 of us, Jamie and Caitlin and the guest, love the movie that we're talking about.
Genuinely.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you for bringing us such an exciting movie to talk about.
About to blast the soundtrack in my car.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Blast it and cry
I'm
home.
Frothing for it. Yeah. I'm so excited.
Where can people find you online?
Wow. I am on Twitter @ Natalie Baseman. And I'm on Instagram, too, and I am off Facebook for mental health. And,
well done.
My Twitter right now is mostly just retweeting angrily, but my Instagram, I post pictures of things I cook.
Wonderful.
Perfect.
What about you, Jamie? Do you have anything you want to mention?
I'm Hamburger Phone on Twitter. You can watch my cartoon every week on Cafe. It's called Boston PD Zamboni Crimes Division.
It's very funny.
And thank you. Caitlin watched me make one today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh.
It was fun.
It was so much fun.
That's all I've got.
You can follow me @ Caitlin Durante, and you can follow the podcast @ Bechdelcast. You can also listen to us on iTunes. You can also rate and review us there. We really appreciate it when you do that.
Yes. And Libsyn and Google.
Google, too.
Also, I don't know if I use the Overcast app for my podcasting needs, and it's amazing, and you can get anything on there. And then it's just a quick hop to iTunes to rate things.
I love it. I use the standard podcast iPhone app as well, and I get a little ping every Thursday morning when it's like, hey, remember this thing?
Remember that thing you did?
It's
now available to the public.
Yeah, love it. So keep listening. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you. We value you. You get 5 out of 5 nipples.
Yes, you all do. Thanks, and bye.
Bye.